Hi, I'm Dr. Hillary McBride. Normally, therapy sessions are totally confidential, but in other people's problems, I open the doors to let you hear sessions with my long-standing clients. This is what people sound like when they talk with someone they trust about healing addiction, parenting stress, racist ideologies in the family, and other topics that feel so timely as we come through this difficult time. Other People's Problems, available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Okay, we're recording. Hey, Laura. It's been a while.
It has been a while since the last episode. But it definitely hasn't been a while since you and I have talked, because we've been cooped up in the same house since before Unlocking Bryson's Brain was even released. Not that I'm complaining.
You would never do that.
Never.
But that is a reminder of how long this pandemic has been going on.
And on and on it has. And we'll get to that. But first, Keith, what are we doing here?
So when we finished the first 8 episodes of Unlocking Bryson's Brain, we knew that this journey wasn't over. And so we always planned to come back and provide updates. And you've kindly agreed to be my co-host for this episode.
And thank you for the invitation. So we're going to talk about what the pandemic has been like for our family.
We'll provide updates into our search for a cure.
Yes, and I'm so excited about where the science is taking us. And we'll also have some special guests.
Yes, we will. And then right at the end, I've got a bit of an announcement. Not to spoil anything, but it might have to do with season 2.
I know what it is.
You do. I'm Keith MacArthur.
And I'm Laura Williams. And this is Unlocking Bryson's Brain,
a podcast about our son Bryson, his rare disease, and our family's search for a cure. So where do we start?
Why don't we start by going backwards? The first 8 episodes covered us searching for almost 10 years to get a diagnosis.
She said, we received the results back and we'd like to see you and Keith. We think we have a diagnosis.
And then finally, through genetics testing, learning that Bryson has Grin disorder.
Right, a rare genetic disease. Now, that didn't really change anything for Bryson, but it still felt huge because we were able to connect with other Grin families and start looking into the science of this rare disease.
There's a lot of hope for rare diseases, including the Grins.
And we traveled to Boston and met with experts at Harvard and MIT and several biotech companies.
It's just probably quite reversible.
And I got together with other parents to co-found Cure Grin, a patient advocacy group to raise money and bring researchers together to find cures and treatments for Grin disorder.
We got the grant.
Shut up.
Are you serious?
We got it.
Are you serious?
And, you know, we also talked about what if a treatment or a cure wasn't possible. So what is the other version of Bryson's future that we need to plan for? One where, you know, he needs ongoing support and care past when we can provide that for him and when we're no longer here on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, after the podcast was released, what was your reaction?
Honestly, it blew me away. I heard from so many families with rare diseases, and not just from parents, but also from siblings and people with their own physical and cognitive disabilities who said that they could really relate to the podcast.
It was really amazing, wasn't it? I heard from people too, and honestly, I didn't think too deeply about how public her story would be until after the podcast was produced. And I'm glad I didn't, because I may have edited myself more. It's so hard to be vulnerable. It's hard sometimes to even listen back. But the outpouring of support was so touching. And it was so nice to hear that our story brought to life the reality of having a child with a disability. Unlocking Bryson's Brain was also nominated for a couple of big international awards, the New York Festival Radio Awards and the AMBYs, which is kind of like the Oscars of podcasting.
So they say. Yeah, so that felt really good. And, you know, I also have to shout out here to the amazing team behind this that helped produce the podcast. It definitely wasn't a one person or a one family production. So we're going to bring in our first special guest now. And I have to say that even though the podcast has Bryson's name, and even though Laura was so eloquent and insightful,
aww,
even though I was the host, and even though we had all these brilliant scientists, this guy was kind of the star.
He sure was. And so our first guest is Bryson's big brother, Connor. We got so much great feedback about how eloquent and wise he came across in the podcast series. And I can confirm that in real life, he is, in fact, both eloquent and wise and quite lovely.
Connor, welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be on the show. It's not necessarily an honor to be recording right here in the physical space because we're packed in like sardines with all the spiders and rusty nails in our basement. So,
well, you were living the dream during COVID.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah, we make do with what we have. So, Connor, we wanted to bring you in here while we talk about how the pandemic is affecting our family now that it's been going on for, what are we up to? Is it 18 years? Connor, how has your pandemic been?
Relatively speaking, I can't complain. It's been okay, with the exception of online school, which honestly was fairly rough. But no, I feel like it's going okay.
Well, you've been a real trooper through all of this. Our family has been in such extreme lockdown for, you know, about a year and a half. And we thought Bryson might be at high risk for COVID-19 because of GRN1, which sometimes includes respiratory issues. And we knew, Keith, that you were at higher risk because of your transplant.
Yeah. So I remember early on when COVID was a big thing around the world, but hadn't really come to Canada yet, one of the early countries was Italy that was impacted. And I remember sitting in a doctor's appointment and reading on Twitter, on like medical Twitter from Italy, where doctors were talking about how there weren't enough ventilators and they had to kind of triage patients. And one of the doctors was talking about how when they were triaging, that patients who had had transplants were not getting prioritized. And so that was something early on that was really quite scary.
Well, I remember you coming to my office right after that. So I work at the hospital and you had just been coming from an appointment and had been, you know, reading Twitter in the waiting room. And that just shook me. That just shook me to my core. Made it very, very real for me that COVID was going to be a big deal for the world and for our family.
Yeah. And maybe even more later on when there was a scientific study that came out and it found that people who got transplants, then got COVID, 20% of them died, which is obviously so much higher than the overall population.
Oh, yeah. And so our lockdown was quite strict given those risks. But after about a year, vaccines started flowing in Canada and it really started to feel like, you know, the end of our strict lockdown was in sight.
Sure. I mean, I feel like I sort of took the more pessimistic approach there. I guess I thought that it wouldn't be over and I wasn't necessarily wrong about that.
Yeah. So it turned out that Connor was right. And so I always knew that I might not have as good an effect from the vaccines as other people would because I'm on these drugs to lower my immunity so my body doesn't get rid of my kidney. And so I went and got a test done. It measures something called spike protein. And basically, I thought that it might be lower, that my antibodies might be lower. But when the test came back, it showed that I had no antibodies at all. And so I felt okay about this for me. But, you know, the doctor said basically I had to keep living as if I had not been vaccinated and as if I was at a high risk still of getting a really serious version of COVID if I were to catch the infection. So this is okay for me. Like, I feel like I can keep living like it's 2020 forever. But I was so worried about what it means, especially for Connor and Bryson.
I can't complain. I'm not complaining.
Well, you're pretty humble, Connor, but you've had to go through online learning and yeah, not good. Really challenging and not seeing your friends in person and not having those visits.
But it's fine. It's fine. Well, you aren't complaining, so I don't see why I should.
Oh, you're a good one. And Bryson, you know, he hasn't been able to to go to school or participate in online learning. And, you know, initially it was okay and he was doing fine, but we've definitely seen some regression over the year and things like his standing and his mobility as his, you know, muscles continue to build up, but his body is, you know, growing much more quickly. So it's harder and harder for him to do things, and he doesn't have the constant stimulation that he would have in a classroom.
Yeah. So just to that point, we weighed him the other day and he was 99 pounds. Is that right?
He sure was.
99 pounds. And so, you know, this is someone who needs help getting around if he's not in his wheelchair. So Connor and I are still carrying him. I guess Laura's like still carrying him even too sometimes, although I don't know how you do it. But yeah, he's definitely grown.
She's tough. She's got big muscles.
Thank you, Connor.
But yeah, I think early on, there were some real positive signs from Bryson. Like I remember when he ate pizza for the first time at the start of the pandemic and he was really chewing it and so excited about it. So that was great. He was doing better in his walker. So that was great. But yeah, lately it's become more and more clear that his development is suffering because of being stuck at home. So it's been tough. Connor, we also wanted to talk about Bryson's episodes, what we call his episodes.
Right. Seizures, and, you know, fury storms, whatever.
Whatever. Yeah. So originally we thought they were seizures. Now we're not so sure. Anyway, I'm going to play a clip from earlier in the series where Connor is describing these. Connor, who is now 16, has witnessed hundreds of his brother's seizures.
So usually he starts off laughing. He either starts off laughing or kind of just humming very loudly and putting his hands on his head almost as if, it may sound kind of graphic, but to protect your head from a blunt force. If it was being applied in multiple areas towards your head.
Then he gets violent. He'll start to kick or scratch or bite himself or those around him.
He kind of like cradles his body as if every muscle in his body is twitching and tensing, and usually tries to kick the things around him, like tables, or just kicks the air in order to kind of like flail about. Usually after around maybe a minute, starts kind of screaming manically. And this like very intense period can last anywhere from like on a good day, a minute, to on a very bad day, like 20. And he usually looks either really happy afterwards or just really disappointed, almost.
Wow, that is still so hard to hear you describe that, Connor.
Yeah, it really is. It's so precise as to what we experience, but it is really hard to hear.
Thank you, and I'm sorry.
No, don't say sorry. You know, we've been trying to find medications that are more targeted based on what we've learned about Bryson's brain through the research that's been happening over the past few years. And so we have an amazing neurologist who's been working with us to trial some different medications. I think they're working. I am seeing some changes in Bryson. It could depend on the day that you ask me. But it does feel like overall there has been an improvement. What do you think?
Yeah, I think definitely he might be having as many during the day, but the really severe ones are less often. And the other thing I've noticed is that we are able to kind of talk to Bryson and help him kind of manage through them. This is something that Edna, Bryson's caregiver, has been doing for a long time. And we finally feel like we're starting to figure it out too.
So we still don't know what they are. We haven't got a name for them. We don't know if they're seizures. We don't know if they're neurostorms or dystonic storms. These are a couple of kind of ideas that have been thrown out as to what they could possibly be.
Yeah, and Bryson's neurologist wanted us to go for more tests that would check for seizures again. And because of COVID, we haven't been able to do that. But, you know, neurostorms, what Laura mentions, one of the theories is maybe this is something to do with his sympathetic nervous system that's kind of going out of control. Maybe it's dystonia, which is a kind of movement disorder that's causing storms. So there's other possibilities of things that are neurological and are kind of outside of Bryson's control, but are not seizures. And so we keep looking into those. Now, Connor, what do you think? What have you seen with Bryson and how they're going?
I feel like I am always pessimist in this family, but I think they're pretty bad, and I feel like they might be getting worse. I don't know. Maybe it's just that he's stronger, a lot stronger, but I mean, it's scary sometimes. I'm worried about him. I'm worried about mom and dad, and just sort of, I don't know, every time feels like a full battle. And trying to make sure everyone's okay.
Which is why we can't give up on finding some kind of treatment or understanding his, you know, underlying condition even better.
Yeah. And you know, it still makes me sad, Connor. I'm sorry that you have to live
through
that. I'm
fine. Stop it. It's okay. Me too. You guys do way more work than I do, especially on that.
Well, thank you, Connor. And thank you for being our first guest.
For sure. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, buddy.
Laura, when we first got Bryson's diagnosis, one of the things that you asked right away was whether it was degenerative, and we were both really relieved to find out that it wasn't. And yet, you know, since then we've heard of GRN1 kids who have died of causes related to GRN disorder. And it's always so sad for us and sad really for the whole GRN community when it happens.
Yeah, it's so heartbreaking. And, you know, it is felt across the community. It's felt by each of us, both for the, you know, the young person, the child who's passed away, but, you know, also for their family. It's the most difficult thing I can imagine that any individual could ever go through. Mm-hmm. And we're really grateful today that Bobby Couch, who lost her son a few months ago now, has agreed to talk to us today. Hi, Bobby. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Yes, ma'am. Thanks for having me.
So, Bobby, can you start by telling us a little bit about Hayden?
I don't know where to start. He was the best. I mean, just the best kid. Just happy when he, you know, wasn't having his, I called him Hayden moments, you know, the unexplained crying or, you know, those types of things that I'm sure all grandparents know about. But he was just so happy all the time and beautiful. From the day he was born, he was always referred to as beautiful. It was never handsome because he had the longest eyelashes just from the beginning and the perfect skin, and he was perfect.
That beautiful smile that we see on your Facebook photos?
Yes. He smiled a lot.
And we see that, you know, the pictures of your beautiful family on Facebook, and it seemed like Hayden had a really close relationship with his sister. And we see those moments where they're, you know, giving kisses and hugs. Seems like it was really special.
I mean to tell you, the day that Sawyer was born, my parents brought Hayden up to the hospital, and you know, they were holding him and they set Sawyer in his lap, and he kind of put his cheek on her head and then just closed his eyes and he leaned down and took a big old lick of her head. And it was like love at first lick is what we've always said. Silly as that sounds, but no. I mean, we were very concerned, you know, when she was born about, you know, the slamming of the hands and, mm-hmm. you know, his uncontrolled movements, but he always seemed to know, you know, whenever Sawyer was either laying on him or beside him, and he was always so gentle.
That's so lovely. And she'll carry that with her, right? So she will always have Hayden with her.
Yes. She, every night at bedtime prayers, you know, she prays that, you know, brother is having fun in heaven, you know, and learning lots of new games and meeting new friends. And at supper time, she'll pray that he's eating the best cheesy noodles or spaghetti or, you know, whatever it is that we're eating. She wants him to have the best of it, too. And
that's great.
That's beautiful. You're making me cheer up. I will be honest with you, Bobby, right now.
I'm really trying to hold it together to get through this. So she and he were best friends.
Can you tell us about Hayden's last day?
Yeah, I'll do my best to get through this. So his last full day was a Sunday, and he had the week before, he had gotten a G-tube put in.
That's a feeding tube.
Yes, and I wanted to hold him in church because, you know, I had to protect his belly, you know, where he had gotten his tube. And so I held him the whole service, and he just snuggled in, and, you know, we sang Joy to the World on that service, and he squealed, you know. And a friend of mine actually snapped a picture of us. She was sitting a few pews back and sent me a picture that day. She said, I just had to send you this picture. And then I held him the whole time. And I couldn't tell you the last time that I held him during church for that long. So that was nice. And then we came home and we had lunch, and my in-laws were in town. And we had a movie night. My mother-in-law held him during the movie. You know, we laid on the couch and he snuggled in, and then we gave him a bath, and he ate a really good supper, like, by mouth. And it was the first time that he had ate really good in a long time. And he had his favorite things. They were cream corn and twice baked potatoes that were super cheesy. And he drank sweet tea. And after his bath, we laid him on his bed and I rubbed him down with lotion, and he just squealed. He loved getting a massage. And James and I said prayers, and that was it.
So you had no idea that this would be his last day?
Nobody had any idea that Sunday would be his last day. No idea.
And do you know what the cause of death was?
So on his death certificate, it says cardiopulmonary arrest. And then underneath it, it says, from complications of GRN1 disorder.
Yeah. So something caused his heart to stop related to GRN, but it sounds like they really don't know why.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Bobby, I'm so sorry. And, you know, we all grieved in the community along with you from afar. But and this all happened during the pandemic as well.
Yes, it did.
So, and how did that impact you and your family being able to really grieve and honor him?
We had Hayden's funeral in Georgia. And because of COVID, we did not have like a service beforehand. We did let immediate family come to the funeral home beforehand. And then for his graveside service, you know, we asked that people wear a mask and social distance, and we didn't have a receiving line. And then when we pulled up at the cemetery, there were so many people there. It's just scattered around the whole cemetery, just to be there for us and to honor Hayden. And his service was, it couldn't have been more perfect. We let Sawyer pick out a song, and anytime he was crying, you know, or having a fit, she would always sing Shine Jesus Shine to him. And we sang that song, and it was just beautiful.
Shine Jesus Shine, fill this land with the Father's glory. Blaze,
it was perfect.
He touched a lot of people.
He did. He really did. I mean, he was on the same hall at school for the 5 years that we are here, and they dedicated that whole hall to him. Sawyer's actually on the yellow hall this year, and She's so excited to be on Brothers Hall, you know, and she said, I'm going to walk by. I'm going to tell him good morning every morning.
It's amazing. How beautiful.
Yeah. Sorry.
No. Please don't say sorry. We have people who, you know, tell us, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how you keep going every day. And I feel like what we've been through is nothing like what your family has experienced and the loss of Hayden. Like, how do you keep going? And how is Sawyer doing?
Sawyer is doing fantastic.
That's great.
She's very open with us, I think, you know, when she has questions about what happened or, you know, anything about Hayden, she seems to always ask us, but we talk to him in our prayers every night and she does. And, you know, she's got pictures of her and Hayden all in her room and her stuffed animals, you know, that Hayden got her. And so she's doing really good. James and I can speak, he's not here, but I can speak for him for the most part. We both fully believed that God gave us the best 10 years that Hayden was going to have. I don't think they were going to get any better for him. I just think that we have to hold on to the fact that we know he's so much better off, even though we gave him the best life. You know, he's in heaven.
And so, as Laura said, you know, when it happens, we're all there with you. But how do you think the legacy of Hayden and other Grin angels should impact our search for treatments and cures?
I mean, the theme, I feel like, of Grin is the unknown. You know, we just, because we don't know much about it, we don't know if this cardiopulmonary arrest is because of Grin 1 or if it was going to happen anyways. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But I really feel like finding a cure or, you know, finding as much out about this disorder that we can would be helpful for everybody already living with it and for those who are going to come along in the future. Obviously, the more information you have on anything is the best. You know, you can know how to prepare for a life with a child with Grin better, you know, than what you and I had when we got our diagnosis. You know, parents deserve to know as much as they can to help their child. It's a little easier with a typical kid. You've got thousands and thousands of books on how to parent, you know. Nothing's mentioned about a grandkid, you know. And I want that for anybody who has a child with Grin. I would love for there to be a cure, of course. But at least the knowledge of how we handled certain things, you know, or ideas on how to handle things or what did you do? And, you know, just to get all the information out there and all the information we can learn to help better the lives of these kids and their families.
Well, in this work, we hope to continue to honor Hayden and the other Grin angels that are, you know, no longer with us. But we're so grateful, Bobby, that you would talk to us today. I know it's so hard, and it's, you know, clear he was a special, special boy, and we all think about him often. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I love talking about him, so.
Bobby, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking about Hayden and letting me talk about him.
Take care.
Yes, y'all too.
Thank you. Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Laura, talking to Bobby is such a reminder of why what we're doing matters, why it's important to connect with families, why it's important, as Bobby said, to understand the disease better.
Yeah, and why it's important to keep pushing for cures and treatments to help our kids.
Yeah, and that search is what so much of this podcast is all about. And there have been some pretty big developments since our last episode. So we're bringing back one of the guests we talked to before, Amy Ramsey.
All right.
Amy is the scientist who's done some of the most promising GRIN animal research. Her experiments are the ones that suggested that GRIN could be cured even in adults. And she's become a friend to both of us. Amy, welcome back.
Hi, Keith. Hi, Laura. Thanks so much for inviting me back.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for joining us.
It's always great to hear your voice.
Oh, you too.
Amy, we've talked a bunch during the pandemic, but it's been almost 2 years since we've seen each other in person. And I know that the pandemic impacted research everywhere. You know, all research that wasn't related to COVID was kind of put on hold. How did that affect the work that you do? And how much do you think that this would have set back progress on rare diseases overall?
I think it's set back research a lot. I think it's exciting to be a scientist right now because you can see what is possible when the world puts its mind and its political will towards solving a medical problem. And the progress that has been done is really stunning for people who are used to the normal pace of things. So I think that it's a good lesson for humanity to see what we can do when we all agree on a problem and how to solve it. But for other types of research, basic research or research with other diseases, yes, we have been put back, I would say, a year. Of the 2 years, we're probably working at 50% capacity. And it's the right thing to do, but it's really hard to confess that to the patient advocates like you guys, you know, to say, yes, we had to shut down. We really had to reduce the experiments that we were doing. And it's been really hard.
Well, Amy, one of the good things that we have been able to do during the time that all the research has been paused is we've been able to kind of take a step back and talk to parents and talk to researchers and come up with a plan for basically what we need to do to find cures and treatments for GRIN disorder. How do you think that's going to help us moving forward?
Yeah, you're right. That has been progress that we've been able to do over the pandemic. And it's a really big deal. I was honored to be part of that, to be part of those discussions. What was illuminating about those conversations that we had and the surveys that you did was that the priorities that parents and patient advocates have, they're different than what I would have guessed. So I would have guessed that motor impairments and low muscle tone would have been really important for parents. But it turns out that they have solutions for those problems. So those are not as high on the priority list as things like cognition and communication and seizures. So those are the things that we really need to be focusing. If we look at therapies or, you know, treatments, we need to be looking at those measurements rather than motor measurements.
Yeah. And what you're saying is, you know, ringing so true for me. If Bryson could communicate with us and, you know, tell us what his needs are, even from a, you know, a basic level, as a parent, I would feel much better equipped to meet his needs. So, you know, one of the meetings we had a couple of years ago when we went to Boston was with a company called Homology. And while we weren't able to record the meeting itself, you and I had recorded our discussion right after. We were pretty excited and learning a lot at the time. So we're just going to play a short clip from that now.
So the big thing that came up is that, like in some of the meetings yesterday, people were talking about how, you know, we sort of have the science to change the gene, but we don't know how to actually deliver it to the brain, right? Like, so delivering gene therapies or gene editing a lot easier in the blood or other organs potentially, but the brain is a real challenge. These guys, they've actually got some technology that they think seems to work really well in early trials at delivering therapies to the brain.
Yeah, so that problem that seemed to me yesterday like a big problem around the delivery system, we actually may have an opportunity to use this delivery system, or trial anyway, this delivery system for whatever therapy that we think might work through the mice model. And that could happen, you know, relatively quickly. I'm just kind of, I don't know, really awed and inspired by the willingness to share when we approach these scientists, and just the depth of knowledge and commitment to this work. Fascinating.
And so we were so excited after that meeting because, as we said in the clip, there was this gap and this Homology team seemed like they could fill it. And they offered to potentially let us use their therapies on our mice. And it's been a long process over a couple of years, partly set back by COVID, but we're actually in a position now where they've kind of formally agreed that they're going to make some gene therapy medicines, and we're going to be able to test this on both GRIN1 and GRIN2B mice that have actual patient variants. And I think one of the mice is the G620R mouse that Graham Collingridge's team made, and is the same variant that Bryson has.
Yeah, this is so exciting. I would not have predicted that we would be here. And I can tell you, Keith and Laura, I would not have had the courage to go and knock on Homology's door and ask for this. You know, so it's really cool that you have brokered this collaboration between the academic labs that have made the mice and between Homology Medicine. And the reason why that's such a big deal is that this company, not only can they provide us the state of the art, you know, gene therapy vectors, but they can make things that are medicine grade. And academic labs can't do that. We don't have the manufacturing ability to make something that could actually go into a human, but they do. So it's very exciting.
Yeah. And, you know, Amy, we're so grateful that you're the one who's going to be working on this. I know that there's things to work through in terms of finalizing making the medicines and figuring out the funding, but we're so excited it's going to go ahead. And I think it's going to be able to help us answer some of the 10 essential questions from our science plan, such as, will gene therapy work, at least on mice? Can it help turn them from a mouse with a GRIN mutant gene that is causing problems into a mouse that's functioning properly? And then potentially that can be translated into humans. And, you know, we'll also find out from mice maybe where the best place is to deliver the gene therapy so that it gets to enough brain cells.
Yeah, I agree. This it turns out from the patient priorities, the you know, the surveys that you sent out, the patient advocates really do want to explore whether gene therapy is viable. And, you know, we have reason to believe that it actually can help. You know, from the work that we did with our mice previously, we do think that we can see some big improvements. And now with these experiments that we're going to be doing with Homology, we're going to find out whether we could deliver a virus intravenously, whether we could deliver it through the cerebrospinal fluid, or whether we would have to inject it directly into the brain, as you said. And ideally, if we could do it just intravenously, that would be, of course, you know, much less invasive for the patients. And so that would be ideal, but we want to make sure that it works. So there's a lot to work out, but it'll give us confidence about whether we can go forward in patients.
During the pandemic, we've also been able to connect with dozens of new researchers and I think attract new researchers to GRIN and GRI research. And one of the researchers we met was Dr. Derek Bowie in Montreal at McGill University. He's actually identified a drug that he thinks could help patients with Fragile X, but could potentially also help patients with loss of function GRIN disorder.
You know, he's studying a different neurodevelopmental disorder besides GRIN disorder. He's studying Fragile X. We've known about Fragile X for a longer time than we've known about GRIN disorder. And so there's a lot more that researchers know about what happens in the brain. And yet there's this common feature that's common between Fragile X and GRIN disorder. And that comes down to what's happening to the NMDA receptor. So what researchers are doing with other neurodevelopmental disorders might also shed light into therapies for GRIN disorder. And that could lead us to an effective treatment a lot sooner than something like gene therapy, where we still have a lot left to work out.
Yeah, so exciting.
It's amazing too, as a parent who's, you know, been part of this and also just watching the evolvement of it, but you know, to see researchers partnering, they have their areas of expertise, but, you know, being all willing to come to the table and to talk about these issues and to look at them as potentially linked, and also to really consider parent and patient priorities.
That's right. I think that it's actually fostered by the involvement of the parents and the patients, because it really reminds us what is important. And you know, so it's very hard to be thinking about career and fame and glory when you have people who have serious concerns that are, you have to look them in the eyes and you have to, it really does make people put their best foot forward. So I think I am very much enjoying being part of a scientific community that has this presence of the patients, so that we're constantly reminded of why we're here, what's important, what we're doing this for.
So there is a mouse. We call it a Bryson mouse, but it's actually, or there's many mice now, but mice with the G620R change. And, you know, we had learned through Graham Collingridge's work and the work of his amazing team in the lab that it is actually a loss of function. So that was, you know, really good information for us to have, so that we could understand, you know, as we go deeper into the science, what's actually going on for Bryson. And it helps us to look at, you know, as treatments evolve, but even in the interim, to understand a little bit more as to what's happening in his brain, you know, trying things that could ease and help some of his symptoms. So just wondering, in terms of the research that's continued, Amy, if you would be able to, you know, summarize some of the latest results that we've had.
Sure. Right. These are results that, like you said, that come from Graham's lab, and they really come the closest to unlocking Bryson's brain, because that was a big deal to make that mouse and to start studying it the way that they have. What they've done since then is to start looking at some of the behaviors of the mice and compare them to wild-type mice, which is mice that have the normal version of the GRIN1 gene. And so there's a battery of behavioral tests that we use to look at different aspects of brain function. So they did things like they looked at how much they were moving. and they put them in an arena, and they have video cameras that track the animal's movement, and they record what the animal is doing. When they did that, they saw that the bison mouse didn't move as much as the wild types. And they also saw that the bison mouse spent a lot of time doing repetitive behavior, grooming type behaviors, where they're scratching themselves or, you know, rubbing their paws on their face, and also a lot of sniffing behaviors. So those things we think of as being correlates to the repetitive behaviors that children exhibit who have autism spectrum disorder. And that is a feature that is also seen in Grin disorder patients. And Keith let me know that there was another child who had a G620R variant, and that child was diagnosed as having autism. So these behaviors that they saw in the mice are exhibiting some of the behaviors that we would expect to see in a mouse model of autism. And the reduced activity that that mouse had, it might be a good measure for things like the low muscle tone that Bryson has. So we'll do some more tests, and they will do some more tests to verify if this is the reason for their reduced motor activity. But it's encouraging that we have these behaviors that are changed, because then once you know you have a different behavior, now you can test different therapies to see whether you can bring it back to normal.
And I think the research that they did that is, to me, almost the most interesting is one where they tried to see how much mice could learn by doing a kind of shock test. And I talked to Graham the other day about it. So I'm just going to play a clip now from my conversation with Graham.
But what this is basically telling us is in this fear memory. So this is obviously a very strong form of learning and memory. It's necessary for survival, that if you go into an environment which is dangerous, you learn not to go there again. So, for example, if you touch an electrified fence, you're not going to make that mistake and touch it again. And this is the ability for these mice to remember. So they're put into an environment where they're given an electric shock. So they don't like that environment. And then they're put back in that environment without the electric shock, but they're nervous. And you can tell that because they freeze. An intrinsic behavior of a mouse when it becomes scared is to freeze.
And what Graham told me is they don't see any difference between the Bryson mouse and the typical wild type mouse.
They don't show any deficits in this at all, which tends to suggest that despite having a reduction in NMDA receptor function, they're able to learn these important fear memories.
And so even though the Bryson mice have less NMDA activity and presumably are only learning at about half of the function of wild type mice, they are able to learn just as quickly or even faster at this test that kind of measures, is it fair to call it fear-based learning, Amy?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, there's many different types of learning and memory, and this is measuring just one of them. So that test is measuring how well someone can remember that an unpleasant experience happened in a certain context. So remembering that the doctor's office is where you go and you get your vaccinations when you're a kid, you might start to get anxious whenever you go to the doctor's office, even if it's just a well child visit, because you remember the last time you were there, you were given a shot in the arm. And so it's that kind of learning to associate certain cues with an unpleasant event so that you would have fear that could happen again. So yeah, it's a measure of fear and anxiety. And it looks like the Bryson mouse was able to form those memories. You know, in a way, you would wish someone couldn't remember something, you know, unpleasant, but really we need to be able to remember. That's part of what the brain should do. So it's encouraging when you see that these aspects of learning and memory are intact.
so interesting to think about. You know, something that Keith and I noticed was that Bryson, you know, fairly early on would actually get upset as soon as we went into the parking lot at the hospital. And we thought, what? How is he, you know, in so many other ways not able to communicate with us? But it was so clear to us that he would, you know, put his hands over his head and sometimes start to cry. And we thought, wow, so he's actually remembering and making associations.
This is fascinating what you've observed. And I think that it's really important that the fact that you have this perspective of the patient and you've observed this associative learning, there's other forms of learning that we can test in the future where we can we could look at things like, can they associate a place with a reward, like a sweet, a sugar pellet or something like that, where they would then seek out that location where they got a sugar pellet. Another thing that can be rewarding for mice would be one of their cage mates. So a mouse that is their friend that they live with, their roommate, they would rather go to a location where that mouse is than to go to an empty location. So we can look and see whether those forms of associative learning are intact. So do you have any insight about Bryson's ability to kind of predict something good is going to happen?
That's a good question. You know, one I'd have to think about more. You know, in terms of when you were talking about the mouse and, you know, predicting socialization, and there's definitely people that Bryson would be, you know, happier to see. So if he hears Connor's voice or we talk about Connor, there does seem to be a really positive response there or kind of an excitement. So I don't know if that's exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, it is. For sure it is. Okay. Yes, for sure it is. Yes, absolutely. So I would say that I would predict that then that you would see in the Bryson mouse that they would also show some memory and some, you know, preference for things that would bring them pleasure and would be, you know, rewarding, would be positive for the mouse.
Yeah, our brains are fascinating, aren't they?
Yes.
Well, Amy, thank you so much for everything you do. And thanks for helping us understand some of this science today.
It's really always a pleasure talking with you, Keith. Thanks so much for inviting me back. Laura, it's great to talk with you too.
Oh, great to speak with you, Amy, and I can't wait till we can actually someday see each other in person again.
Me too. Me too.
Take care.
You too.
Isn't she amazing?
Oh, she's unbelievable. I'm just so humbled and have so much gratitude for Amy.
Mm-hmm. And I'm so excited to find out what's going to happen with this gene therapy trial.
Well, and it all started with that trip to Boston to meet with biotech companies. You know, to me, it's such a reminder that while you need doctors and scientists to cure rare disease, we need their expert minds. You also really need patients or their parents to advocate and push.
Yeah, absolutely.
So before we wrap up, you promised some more exciting news.
I did. And I hinted what it's about. It's about another season of Unlocking. And this relates to something that we talked about a lot in the original 8 episodes. And that's our biggest fear for Bryson's future. What's going to happen to Bryson when you and I can't take care of him anymore?
Oh, I still worry about this every single day. If anything keeps me up at night, it's this particular thing.
Absolutely. And I talked to so many other Grin families as I was putting together those first 8 episodes, and I asked them what their biggest fear about the future was. Unanimous. That's what everybody's worried about. So there are kind of 2 ways that we've been looking at dealing with that, like answering that question. Do you want to talk about what those are?
So one was to find cures and therapies that might allow him to live independently. I can't imagine what that would look like. It would be so wonderful. And 2, to try to find or build a safe and healthy living arrangement or community for him.
Yeah. And so those are 2 options. Now, here's a crazy third option. What if you and I could each live for 150 years and have decades more years of healthy living?
Sure, sure.
Before we start to get things like cancers and diabetes and heart disease and stroke.
Okay, that sounds amazing, but not very likely.
Yeah, it sounds like science fiction. But if it could be possible, it would allow us to take care of Bryson for much longer. So on this upcoming season, I'm exploring the mysteries of aging. I'm going on a journey to learn about the science to make people live longer. Scientists are trying to slow down or even reverse the aging process.
So you're searching for the fountain of youth.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be the first. People have been searching for ways to avoid or delay death for thousands of years. And there are some wacky stories I'm going to share about this. But I'll also get into the good science. There's probably hundreds of research papers that have been published where scientists have shown that they can dramatically increase lifespan in animals. So they're living like 2 or 3 times longer than they're supposed to. And a lot of researchers in the space feel like they're getting closer to being able to extend human life too.
And so how much longer can we live?
Okay, so up till now, according to the Guinness Book of World Records, the longest anyone has lived is 122 years. And there are already medicines that are about to be tested that could add a few years to that. But several scientists think it's possible that people alive today will live to 150 years. And one even thinks someone alive today in their 40s or 50s will live to 1,000.
So you've been telling me about the science as you've been learning it. And I know we can't get into it here, but some of what you've learned already is pretty mind-blowing.
It is, yeah. No, there's so much fascinating research. And it's worth noting, too, that both you and Connor also make appearances in the new season.
We do. And so can we talk about the tests?
Yeah, let's do it.
So Keith and I are both getting blood tests that will measure whether our physical age is higher or lower than our actual age. I didn't realize that you could slow down or speed up your age. Some mornings I think I feel much older than I am, but it would be great to think I could reverse that even just a bit. So when is Unlocking the Fountain coming out?
Well, so people can get, I guess, a first sneak peek next week when we're launching the trailer. And the first episode is going to come out in late September.
Yay, so exciting.
It is. Well, Laura, thank you so much for joining me today. This was fun.
It was fun. See you in season 2.
See you then. Unlocking Bryson's Brain is hosted and written by me, Keith MacArthur. I was joined today in hosting duties by Laura Williams. Our associate producers are Sarah Melton and Graham McDonald, who also does our sound design. Our digital producers are Emily Cannell and S.K. Robert. Chris Oak is our story editor. Our senior producers are Tina Verma and Tanya Springer. Our executive producer is Arif Noorani. Special thanks to Connor Williams MacArthur, Bobby Couch, Sawyer Couch, and Amy Ramsey. And of course, to Bryson for letting me tell his story. To learn more about Grin Disorder, please visit curegrin.org. And join us on September 28th for the first episode of Season 2, Unlocking the Fountain.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.